Encouraging usable designs for a better customer experience, this is Design Critique, Products for People, number 51, for November 23rd, 2008. This episode is the first of several interviews I obtained from User Interface 13, held in Cambridge, Massachusetts, on October 13th through 16th of 2008. The first episode we have here is an interview with Dana Chisnell. She talked about the quick, the cheap, and the insightful, conducting usability tests in the wild. This interview takes about 19 minutes, give or take, and after that we're going to read some email, so thank you for listening. Dana Chisnell, welcome to another episode of Design Critique, Products for People.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
And where is here? So the audience knows exactly where we are. We're at User Interface 13.
Yes, in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
And we just ate ice cream because Jared knows how to throw a conference.
He does.
I say most people put on a conference or host a conference. I say he throws on a conference. Because, folks, after his keynote, we opened up the doors to the hallway where the snack was for the break, and they had all these hot fudge sundae and hot caramel and all these sundae stations. Well, sundae being the ice cream terminology.
Right,
I don't know.
Right.
Internationally, I don't know if that's what it's known by. Email us at designcritique@gmail.com and let us know if ice cream with all kinds of toppings on it is referred to as a sundae in your locale. Yeah, I don't know. But the ice cream is very good. I had vanilla with the melted caramel and the melted fudge, Dana. I had both of them.
Oh.
How'd you design your ice cream?
I had chocolate ice cream with whipped cream and the caramel topping.
Did you have any of those cherries or the strawberry stuff?
No, but I had the crushed Heath bar stuff, the toffee.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was good. I like crunchy things with my ice cream.
All right. Well, that's our episode on designing ice cream sundaes. Thank you so much for joining us. No, I wanted to talk to you, Dana, because people probably remember you from the episode you recorded this past summer when your and Jeff Rubin's book, The Handbook of Usability Testing, second edition, came out.
Mm-hmm.
And you are here at User Interface 13 to talk to us about the quick, the cheap, and the insightful usability testing in the wild.
Right.
You were also doing a full-day session yesterday. I forget the name of that. I was actually not present. I was at something else. But
that was usability testing techniques on a shoestring.
Right. So what I saw you in this morning was the quick, the cheap, and the insightful usability testing in the wild. And one thing that impressed me out of the many things that did was that you started off by showing your book that you and Jeff wrote, and you showed us, you know, here's the classic usability test process.
Mm-hmm.
And then you showed us, it was right from the book. It started off with develop a test plan, choose a testing environment, find and select participants, prepare test materials, conduct the sessions, debrief with participants and observers, analyze data and observations, and create findings and recommendations. So you had a slide that had those things on there that are right from the book, and then you had another slide where you put a strike through probably three quarters of all of those parts of the process and said, but here's what you can do if you're outside the lab and you're usability testing something. So what's that all about?
Well, you know, even though there is a pretty tried and true methodology that's been around for, I don't know, 25 or 30 years, you don't have to do it by the book. You know, if you have an opportunity to gather data, but you don't have the time or the resources to do it the classic way,
mm-hmm.
you can definitely cut out some of the steps and get excellent data that really will help you inform the design of whatever it is that you're working on. So it's about seizing the opportunity.
It's interesting that some of the feedback from the session was saying, how is this going to be received by the executives or by clients, as opposed to the classical testing where you have your fully outrigged lab and maybe even your one-way glass and you have all kinds of stuff going on.
Is it one way or two way? I always
glass usually lets you see through two ways in a window.
That's
like the
true.
One we're overlooking Cambridge right now, and
yeah.
We can see beautiful downtown Cambridge, Massachusetts, where User Interface 13 is currently ongoing. No, I call it one way because it's still glass. You can see
right.
through it, except on the one side you can't. So for me, it's a one way glass.
Right. Okay, that makes sense.
Because a mirror would just reflect.
Right.
So these people are asking, how do you think this is received by your clients or by your employer when you do something that seems so minimal and you're out there where the users are, where they normally work, or environments such as you mentioned, I think a library at a college where people were studying, or you met them in the coffee shop where they'd been studying, and that's a very noisy environment. They said, how can you take those results back to people and be taken seriously? And you had a good answer to that.
I did.
You did. I wrote it down, but well, part of what you said was this kind of go to the field and usability test where people are doesn't have all the trappings of the classic method, but the benefit of being actually where they do their stuff is one benefit. And you said the other benefit is you tell them, look, this is what we could do with the time and the resources we had, and here's what we learned, and we would not have learned this otherwise.
Right.
And it doesn't cost as much.
Yes.
And it may be gotten quicker, too, depending on results.
Oh, definitely. It takes a lot less planning, right? You don't have to book the space. You don't have to do a lot of scheduling of the participants. You can just show up where participants would normally be and ask them very nicely if they would mind giving you a little bit of time. So it's dead easy to put together once you have people on your team who are interested in doing it. And I say people on your team because having one or two observers with you is really helpful when things are happening quickly and you're working kind of spontaneously. But being out there where the users normally do their stuff with your design also gives you this great contextual information, right? You get some idea about the environment that they're working in and the other paraphernalia maybe that's around them while they're using your design, which should influence how you implement your design.
And from our tech ed days, we used to do kind of a piggyback usability test in the wild with an ethnographic interview that got two birds with one stone, as we say.
Yep.
And
so you get huge value
effective.
That way.
Very much, because the ethnographic interview, you had your prepared, focused questions to ask them, but then at the end we would say, now would you do a few tasks that we're going to ask you to do here? And it was a really effective method to combine those things and actually be where the users are.
Mm-hmm.
And now today we were talking about just the usability test portion of that, and you whittled down the classic method to just a few points here. One was develop a test plan, find participants, conduct the sessions, debrief with observers. You said develop a test plan is still crucially important for this. You just don't take a drive to a participant or to the coffee shop and do an ad hoc usability test. We're not advising that, and you certainly weren't doing that when you wrote the book or talked to us.
No, right. You know, in the book, there are about 40 pages about how to write a test plan.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of prose description of the various parts, you know, the experiment design, what the research questions are, things like that. When I, in this situation, talk about make a test plan, I'm talking about, okay, meet with the design team, decide why you want to do the test, what you want to find out, what the questions are you want to try to answer while you're with the user, and then roughly what you're going to do with the data that you gather. How, you know, can you do anything about the issues that might turn up? And if you can, what that might be. So it could be a bulleted list as long as the people who are involved see the vision of the project and basically agree on what you're going out there for.
You mentioned something I wrote down in my notes that I thought was really great. You said 20% of the value in testing in the first place is from working with your coworkers to prepare to test.
Yeah.
Because it forces a discussion amongst various team members to really say, what do we really care about with the product in the first place?
Right.
It may do a lot of things, but what do we really care about? And that's what we're going to test. But this discussion among team members before you ever go out to do the usability test has a value that would still be there even if all the test sessions were canceled later.
Exactly.
And you never got to do the test.
Exactly.
But you would have had those discussions with your employees or your coworkers.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, if you do the classic methodology where you do all the steps and it takes time and a lot of buy-in, there is the temptation to pile on a lot of things to investigate during the session. You know, everybody has their agenda. Market research has theirs. The business side has theirs. IT has theirs. But when you know that you're going to have finite time, you know, tiny, tiny little bits of time and little bits of opportunity to go gather usability data from real people in real environments, this really focuses the group, the team, and helps them come to a very tight definition of what they want to look for. And so the great thing about that is that it sort of compartmentalizes and concentrates the discussion to what the priorities now are, mm-hmm. and what we can do in the short term. Whereas if you do a really big test, at least in my experience, my clients have tended to want to look at this in a much more strategic way. It's a bigger thing, so it might span larger parts of the project. This way you can do kind of localized, very focused bits.
Very, very quick to start up and then right. finish.
Right.
Another thing you mentioned was that what you called Q&D tests, which is short for quick and dirty, can help you design a later classic test with a little bit of foreknowledge.
Right.
Because you might really want to do something whole hog.
Yeah, exactly.
But what if you did some of this, go see the users and do these very quick and dirty type things? That would inform you to design the later classic test. Right. And you might have learned something that actually alters what you ask or what you have people do in that, too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you've got all this field data, right, because you've gone to where the users are. So you have neat stuff about context and environment. And doing these quick and dirty tests with users in a more spontaneous way gives you a lot of data on which to form really good task scenarios, because you're in a much more realistic situation than you might be if you just started out with a lab test, a classic kind of usability test. So you can justify doing these kinds of spot tests very quickly by looking at them as pilots for other research that you might want to do. So in the session that we did today, I tried to talk about what I felt was essential, just the very essence of doing usability testing, and then what were the things that were nice to have. And so tried to give some direction about, if you want to go and do this, what's the minimum that you have to do, but also what the risks are and what the trade-offs are from doing a minimal kind of usability test.
Yeah, I think you said one of the trade-offs is that you're not going to get much, if at all, quantitative data from this kind of a usability test.
Right.
But being out in the field means you're going to have a wealth of qualitative stuff anyway. This is a good thing.
Right.
But just make sure you're doing the right thing for the right reason.
And understand what you're getting and how you're getting it.
Somebody asked a very good question. And if you're listening to this episode and you were here, I'll thank you for it. I don't remember who it was. They asked a question about how in usability testing, sometimes you end up testing the learnability of a product or a system versus actual ease of use for people who already use it and know how to use it.
Yeah.
And I wanted to have you respond to that because it was such a good question. You started off by saying you might not have the time with a quick and dirty test to really train people to use something to get ease of use. A lot of the formative tests we do are almost always testing learnability.
Yeah, they really are.
So maybe talk about how maybe summative testing is not what you want to use this for. You know, just there's a way to use the method to get the right things, and there's a way to waste your time, depending
right.
what you want.
Right. Quick and dirty, going out and doing very kind of spontaneous tests with light planning is great at the early end of the design cycle where you're just forming ideas for the design. It's terrific for taking prototypes out too, right? But if you're closer to the end of a cycle where you have something that's pretty solid and what you want to do is check against a baseline that you may have developed sort of as you have a more solid product, then quick and dirty is probably not the thing that you want to do. Having more controls and having a more consistent approach to doing a usability test, much closer to doing it by the book, mm-hmm. is probably what you want to do instead. If you're doing measures like tracking numbers of errors and whether you're prompting people and where that might be happening, where people take wrong turns on the way to reaching their goals, if they leave things out as they're working on transactions, for example, or I hate to say this, but possibly tracking time on task,
uh-huh.
All those quantitative measures are going to be done much more reliably in a more controlled situation. I'm not saying that's a lab necessarily, but it's definitely not a quick and dirty kind of a test like oh, you're talking about this morning.
Right. You don't necessarily have to have a lab to get those things, but a controlled situation is certainly much more helpful in getting consistently accurate quantitative things. In the coffee shop, randomly finding people or meeting people there, maybe not so much.
Yeah.
So you said designing the test minimally. Why are you testing? You need to answer that. What questions are you trying to answer? What constrains the design? And what are you going to do with what you find out? That last question, a lot of people don't think about.
They forget about it, yeah.
They know it's good to go find out what's happening in the real world.
Right.
But a lot of people don't think about what are you going to do with this when you find out, or talk to their client or their superiors about it.
And sometimes it's just coming back and telling everyone else what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's going to management and saying, we went out and talked to a few users, and this is what they said. This is what happened in these sessions. It's sort of the beginning of gathering evidence to inform the design. But yes, having in mind something about what you're going to do with the data that you collect is pretty important when you're deciding whether to do this.
Depending on the maturity of your organization with regard to usability practices, I'm wondering if this last one, what are you going to do with what you find out, if you don't clear that up front with people, when you come back from the field with this wonderful data, it just might get swept in a report and never read or never applied. And why do all that unless you've made sure people are ready to, you know, see you when you come in the door with your results? What are you going to do with those? Unless it's a hostile situation, you just have to do this on a sneaky way just to have the data for later.
Right, exactly. I mentioned doing it for stealth.
Yeah, yeah.
Or doing it in a stealthy way this morning. Sometimes you do have to just go do it. And start gathering data. You know, you could do a session on your lunch hour or whatever a couple times a week, and over a couple of weeks end up with...
Sneaking out of the office with an audio recorder and paper prototypes, hoping no one wonders, what's that audio recorder doing in your bag? Are those paper prototypes? Were you going out to look at the real world?
Right. Well, I mean, in the case... I've had a couple of clients who said that they actually started out that way, that they couldn't get approval to do... a more rigorous, methodological, dogmatic usability test. But they really felt like they needed to go see some users and get some data directly from their users. And they knew who the users were. It wasn't as if they didn't exist or that it was some novel kind of user group. There were people who were available. And so this client took it upon herself to spend a little bit of extra time a couple of times a week meeting with users and gathering data. And then over time, over a few weeks, she was able to put together an argument for doing a larger study because she had learned these really interesting things, got these insights that when
she could not have gotten any other way.
Exactly, exactly. And when she shared them with the sales operations people and the marketing people, they, you know, light bulbs went on for them. And so it helped her build a little case. But, you know, getting the approval to do it the first time just was not going to come because people thought it was hard or expensive, or it sometimes companies think that people from inside the company should not be exposed to the customer.
Yeah, definitely. And you're not saying that this person would have been breaking any disclosure things by going out there and showing these real users what was going on. It's not like they're breaking policy to that degree.
Right.
They're just doing something that didn't have a budget item for it.
Exactly.
Because they, whatever reason, they couldn't get buy-in at that time.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So they're not
breaking...
Yeah, there
were no trade secrets.
Yeah, there's not breaking company rules or risking litigation or anything like that.
No, of course not. That's an excellent point.
Yeah, we wouldn't be advising that to any of you out there to do that. Well, thank you so much for taking 15 minutes to talk with me while the ice cream sinks into our systems. And we probably should get back down there and see what other sessions are going on. But I want to close with this thing that you mentioned to us at the end of your session, which I thought was very good, which is that all data is good data, just realize what you have.
Yeah.
Could you just riff on that for a second? And what you were... had in your mind when you said that?
Yeah, well, you know, if you don't have any data, you're guessing about what to do with the design, right? If you have some data, at least you have some way to inform what you're doing. If you go out and do these quick, cheap usability tests with real users in their real environment, you do have good data, real data, on which to base decisions that you can share with the rest of the team. And, that's all a good thing. There are possible pitfalls to doing it because you might have only a little bit of data. You might have participants who are not exactly perfect to the target audience.
Mm-hmm.
But you can compensate for those things in other ways.
Dana Chisnell, thank you so much for being on Design Critique with me. Will you come back sometime in 2009 and talk about all this usability of voting systems and ballots and things that you've been doing with so many other people?
Thanks, Tim. I would love to talk.
And maybe bring some of the people with you. I mean, it might be a big panel we could have. We can record it. If they can talk about the work you've all been doing.
Oh, well, you know, it's all public. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't see any reason why not.
Well, let's plan that for early next year.
I'd love that.
Let's do that. Thank you so much, Dana. You take care.
Thank you.
And I'd like to thank User Interface Engineering for sponsoring this particular episode of Design Critique. They gave us the press pass to attend User Interface 13, and I appreciate the opportunity to get these good interviews. Now, on to some email. It's always good to get email. The first one here, and please forgive me if I mispronounce your name, is from Aydinkan Ataberk in Turkey. It says, "Hello from Istanbul, Turkey. I am listening to your podcast show for a while since I bought my first iPod Nano 3 months ago, and I found Design Critique terrific. First of all, as a user and interaction designer, thank you for such a great content and effort. I had a blog about design management for a year and a half in Turkish, but it is inactive now because I hadn't decided yet what content I should put in the future. It has been a hard job for me to write a blog, so I paused. Now I would like to create a podcast in Turkish, and having designcritique.net as a role model, if you permit me to do so, I would like to hear your thoughts about such an approach. My firm, KK34, is an interactive agency transforming gradually to a service design company, which will be the first one in Turkey so far. Again, thank you." Well, this is just magnificent, and I know I already sent you a note, but I just wanted to read your note on the air. In the podcast itself, because it's a thrill to get an email from Turkey, and I wish you all the best with KK34 as well as the podcast you eventually do. I think it would be marvelous if people were to do similar things like Design Critique in their native languages. All right, moving right along, we have a note from Cecil. This is back in regard to the shaving show. And in fact, I had two notes from Cecil, so I'm going to combine the best of them here. Really good remarks about shaving. First one here, "You guys are just too young. Google or search eBay for a Twinplex stropper, Gillette adjustable safety razor, and safety razor honer stone. Old carbon steel blades take the best edge. Even new stainless blades, cared for, will last a long time. Now that green is all the rage, I don't understand why these basic men's grooming devices haven't made a comeback. I guess those Sharper Image nasal hair trimmers and navel lint swizzle sticks are just too shiny to avoid." And he goes on to say, "Disposable razors are for men who carry purses." Oh, this is great. And he included a picture of the Twinplex stropper. And what it is, to my eye, is a pencil sharpener, except it's half the size of a normal pencil sharpener. But you open it up and you can sharpen, well, strop double-edged razor blades that would fit in those old antique safety razors that we've talked about before on the episodes. So I thought that was really interesting. And he also sent some wonderful pictures of the old safety razors. And I highly recommend you look up Twinplex stropper on the internet and look at them for yourself. It's fascinating. And as he says, very green. Let's see. He continues, "I've had a beard for all of about 2 months since 1973. Shaved twice as a catharsis." More of a Gabby Hayes comment. "You're not from around here, are you, young fella?" You have to know who Gabby Hayes is. I'm sorry if some of the non-American listeners wonder what the heck I'm talking about. Good old sidekick actor in cowboy movies. That's what I would think of Gabby as. Anyways, Cecil goes on here, "I only shave my neck. The Twinplex stroppers are really great. I'll leave the blade in the stropper until the next shave, clean and dry. No need to risk a Sweeney Todd on a straight razor. My last barber shave was before a big date in high school in 1967. This is interesting. He said, "You need perfect skin for a straight razor and good binocular vision." That probably is true, come to think of it. Those straight razors probably just lop off anything that's kind of uneven on a face if you're not careful. So, interesting. Anyways, he goes on to say, "You can find new old stock Twinplex stroppers on eBay. My favorite has a brown crinkle finish and clear plastic top. Some have a curved honing stone in the top cover. The old Gillettes are indestructible and adjustable enough to allow for considerable bloodletting." Oh my goodness. Anyways, thank you, Cecil, for your notes. And everybody go out and look at these old safety razors. There's also Merkur from Germany who makes the new ones. And it seems to me stropping double-sided razor blades would make them last a heck of a lot longer and make the whole enterprise even cheaper. So that's pretty neat. Now we have a note from Jorg Enkel. Hello, Jorg. Jorg says he thought of sending me something here because it's an Amazon description of their new frustration-free packaging, which of course reminded him of our old episode with Dr. Bix from Michigan State's School of Packaging. I'm going to put the URL in the show notes for this episode so we can all look at it. Jorg says, I immediately thought of your podcast you did a while ago, number 35, about packaging. Very nice that the power Amazon has leads to customer and environment-friendlier solutions. They even got a photo and video contest going on the site. I like that a lot. User experience becomes ever more important. So thank you, Jorg. I did not know about that till I got your note, and then I saw something on Amazon itself. They were promoting it, and I think it's terrific. So everybody go look at the link that I'm putting in the show notes. Speaking of which, the show notes are on the blog page at designcritique.net. Also, you can find them in the metadata field of the MP3 file. The lyrics field is where I put the show notes, so you don't necessarily have to go to the blog page to get the show notes. Well, that wraps up another episode. If you have any comments or questions, please don't hesitate to email at designcritique@gmail.com. As always, thanks for listening.